Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Killer Jeans.
She was an inspiration to me, and there wasn't anybody like her in our family.
Why did a beloved school teacher leave her home at 3 in the morning?
The surveillance video we have is at night, and we don't see who's in the car.
And a key piece of evidence in the mysterious murder out of Wilmington, Delaware, comes from an unlikely source.
This is one of those things that I have a hard time with still, that her heart rate stopped at 7 a.m.
What happened to Susan Ledyard down by the river's edge?
The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised.
Emmy-nominated true crime journalists bring you cases like you've never heard them before. Hear firsthand accounts from the victims' families, private investigators, lawyers, law enforcement, and even the convicted. Giving you a complete 360 of the case like no one else can.
I'm Melissa McCarty.
I'm Kelly McClear.
And this is Killer Jeans.
50-year-old Susan Morrissey Ledyard grew up in a close-knit family with two sisters, Missy and Meg, and a younger brother, John.
We all got along very well as kids, and we had, you know, a really lovely childhood, and we all had our kind of different strengths. She was crafty, she could really draw beautifully, and none of us had that, so that sort of set her apart.
When Susan went off to college, she made sure her little sister Meg Morrissey didn't feel abandoned.
She encouraged me to come visit her and stay for weekends, and she'd take me out and introduce me to her friends, and that was the best.
Susan always knew what her life purpose would be. In fact, it was a common passion in the Morrissey family. There's more than one educator in the family. Tell me about the passions that led to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting that 3 out of 4 of us ended up as teachers. And our parents weren't educators. I wouldn't have predicted necessarily for all of Susan was drawn to it the earliest. And she taught right out of college. She was recruited to teach English at Czech Tech, which was a university in Czechoslovakia, in Prague.
John, the youngest sibling, says that relocation to teach in Prague cemented her already independent spirit and her place as his idol.
You know, when I was 17 years old, and she came back from Prague. She had been in Prague for about a year. And I mean, she was like, I couldn't believe that the coolest kid I knew all of a sudden was my sister. I think I was smoking the same brand cigarettes as her. I think I was, my mannerisms had turned into hers a lot. I was laughing like her. I was using little silly buzzwords like killer, like that's killer.
Meg remembers Susan having a very endearing teaching style.
I think she immediately decided to teach high school. She just felt drawn to that age group as opposed to teaching, you know, say first or second grade. And I think that's because of the way she related to the students and appreciated them at that age. But also she was then allowed to really dig as deep as she could into literature and language.
Was just really trying to let them know that they're cared about, that you care about them, and that they're safe and that they're in a safe space. She treated them maybe a little bit less like just conversationally in class. I think she treated them maybe less like children than most teachers would have done. There was a lot of talking.
And Susan's sister Missy tells us that Susan did more than just talk.
She cared so much about people, and not just people she knew, people in the world. She was more politically aware than anyone I knew of at such an early age. She loved animals. She became a vegetarian at age 8. She would not eat an animal. She was in a program saving the lions, sea lions in San Francisco early, early on cold mornings on the weekend after teaching all week. She was a brilliant teacher. Her students miss her. They loved her. She had a way of reaching them that was just so special. And they had such fun with her. And she's just really, really cool, interesting person. She had so much depth.
But the Academy Park High School teacher would look for more in life, finding it with Ben Ledyard, a single father of two who had been a longtime family friend.
It was immediate. I mean, they were together pretty much from that night on. They started dating. And he was living in Pennsylvania at the time. She moved to the farm, I think, within the year. You know, it seemed quick to me. But of course, I think in my experience, people who, you know, get together in their 40s tend to have a little more together and know what they're doing. Maybe move a little faster. And they were together ever since. And it was nice that he was a person we knew already.
Ben had gone to grade school with Susan's older sister, Missy. So the Ledyards and the Morrisseys knew each other well.
I was happy that she seemed happy.
In the summer of 2019, the Morrissey family took their yearly vacation. Missy remembers their last trip together.
Well, she's a teacher, and she was out for the summer, so she was definitely in her happy place. Sun, outdoor time, didn't have to get up so early, could stay up late. We were at the beach. My mother has a house in Stone Harbor, New Jersey, and Meg and her family come for 3 weeks every July. So we all try to spend as much time as we can down there during that 3 weeks. I would say Susan was down there for the majority of the 3 weeks. So she would have just come off of a wonderful vacation. She told a friend at school, a teacher, that if you wanted to know the real her, it was with her family in Stone Harbor. It was wonderful. So Susan came home Saturday, and then she died that Tuesday morning.
July 23rd, 2019, a Tuesday morning. At 7:39 a.m., the body of Susan Ledyard is found in the Brandywine River by a construction worker. Detective Daniel Grassi of the Delaware State Police headed up the investigation.
The witness was just a worker in the area. The bridge near where she was found was closed for construction. And he was one of the construction workers. And he just said, you know, called Wilmington police, said there was a body in the river, and they responded out.
Meg Morrissey remembers hearing the worker's account of finding her sister dead.
And one of the construction workers saw her and, in fact, said that she was caught up on a tree limb or something, you know, a significant one. And that he said if she hadn't been caught on that, she would have ended up in Delaware Bay, most certainly, which would have been awful because then we may never have found her.
The moment a family gets the call is one that affects everyone differently.
I mean, I can't put into words what that phone call was like. And then I called my sister Missy and told her, which was excruciating.
I remember thinking at the time that Susan must have had a car accident because I didn't have any facts at that time, and I just couldn't picture anything else. I could hardly picture that. And I don't remember exactly what I told my mother. She might remember better. I just remember sitting her down first and kneeling by her chair and taking her hand and telling her that Susan had had an accident and that she hadn't made it. And my mother just very quietly said, "Oh no. Oh no. No, Missy. Oh, Missy."
How did the popular local school teacher, loving sister, and wife end up dead in the river? And even more puzzling was the fact that her vehicle was also found that morning, approximately 3 miles away, at an area called Walker's Mill. Detective Grassi had to retrace Susan's moments the night before, and what they found was even more of a mystery.
We have her on her cell phone up until about 15 minutes before her car backed out of the driveway. And in the time before that, we know she was in contact with old friends by text and by call. That ceased at about 2:45, and like I said, around 3 a.m., her car reversed out of the driveway and drove down to the location where it was parked.
Missy Morrissey was one of those people Susan was texting with the night before.
Now, she was a texter, and she was sometimes a late-night texter, especially after school lets out, when she can kind of kick back and enjoy her evenings. She had gotten into a lot of conversations because her husband had gone to a movie with a friend that night. I know she was on Poshmark updating some of her stuff that she had there. She was talking to old friends. She was talking to former roommates. And then I texted her around midnight. And we texted until 12:29. And it was like any other night.
Hey, everyone. If you're feeling depressed or struggling with uncertainty or even having difficulty sleeping, BetterHelp offers experienced therapists who can listen and help you. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your very own licensed professional, and you can start communicating in under 48 hours.
It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. Also, the service is available for clients worldwide.
And you can log into your account anytime from anywhere and send a message directly to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in that uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy.
BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they can make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. And it's more affordable than traditional online counseling, and financial aid is available.
In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. Killer Jeans is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy, and our listeners get 10% off their first month of online therapy at betterhelp.com/killerjeans.
That's betterhelp.com/killerjeans. Get matched with a BetterHelp therapist and get started.
Missy remembers what investigators told her what happened after those last text messages.
Detective Grassi said that she left at 3:02 in the morning. Her car left, I should clarify. They can't make out who was driving or if there were multiple people in the car, but they can see her car clearly leave the driveway at 3:02 in the morning, make a left on Pennsylvania Avenue, heading north, make a right on Rising Sun Avenue, and drive. It's about a mile from her house to 1 Walker's Mill Road, where she parked. They believe she drove straight there because it only took her 2 minutes to get there. And there were cameras that caught her going from her house to Walker's Mill. Unfortunately, none of them sharp enough to make out, again, who was driving or how many people were in the car.
Did Susan and Ben's house, did they see the vehicle leaving a garage, or was it parked in a driveway,
the vehicle?
I believe they could only see the car leaving the driveway. I never saw Susan's car parked in the garage, but I couldn't say whether it had been that morning.
So, what happened at Walker's Mill? And now there was cameras over at Walker's Mill, correct?
There was one camera at Walker's Mill, yes.
And what did that capture?
Headlights at 3:04 in the morning that turned off very, you know, moments after they arrived. The camera is so far away that it could only make out headlights, not one bit of a trace of a car, a shadow of a car. It's just headlights. But the headlights were in the exact position of her car once it got light out. So they made, you know, the obvious assumption that it was her car.
So it was still her car, but the lights just shut off. There's no way to tell if anybody exited the vehicle or entered the vehicle. But when the sun came out and the vehicle was found, it was still in that same exact position.
Yes.
Okay.
And as far as we know, they could never see a door opening, people getting in or out, a person in the car, no people in the car.
Based on video surveillance that we have, she drove her vehicle from her house to where it was parked. And so I don't think someone put her car there. I'm pretty sure she went there intentionally.
Not only the why, but the location of where Susan's vehicle was found would leave Detective Grassi stumped.
What is that place? And did she have any ties to it?
It's an accounting firm. But the what's notable about that area is that that building is, it's an old mill building. And across the river, there's another old mill building. There's a dam there. It's a real scenic area. And people do go down there to go for walks and things like that. So I wouldn't get too keyed up on the business itself. I think it's more the general area. It's very scenic. The area where the vehicle was found, I wouldn't say it's desolate, but it's not very highly traveled.
So it's an area that anyone would know or only a local where the car was found?
I would say only a local. You really have to know where you're going to find your way down there.
Are there a lot of transients in the area? I mean, I know that doesn't really add up to certain other reasons, but I wonder if it was a crime of opportunity, maybe?
Anything's possible. I wouldn't say it's a high transient area. I mean, there's people that hang out in the park just because it's a city park, and there's a lot of places to hide, for lack of a better term. You know, it's like heavy tree cover. You can camp out in there if you're homeless, but I wouldn't say it's like a homeless hotspot or anything like that.
Susan's sister Meg knows the area well.
You know, people read early on the reports that her car turned into an office building, and I think they picture that it was an office, proper office building or an office park. But this is a little lane off of a little lane, and then this, you know, this old building, renovated old building. Beautiful. I mean, it's by the banks of the river. This is an area with multiple old mill buildings that used to be part of the DuPont, you know, gunpowder operation.
Susan's last text messages were at 2:45 a.m. Her vehicle is found abandoned just a short ways away from her home, but no surveillance cameras picked her up, or anyone else for that matter, exiting the vehicle. Then her body is found at 7:39 a.m. in the river. So were investigators looking at a suicide, a tragic accident, or a homicide?
She wasn't exhibiting any signs of suicide. She was making plans. She was talking about going to the Stones concert that night. You know, she had just gotten back from a vacation with her family. There was nothing that pointed towards suicide. Because it didn't immediately appear to be a homicide, right off the bat, our major crimes unit goes out, and there's a major crimes unit in each county. So the detective from the major crimes unit, my partner in this case, Amy Lloyd, she went out to the scene where the vehicle was. And I think it was the next day when she called and said, hey, we have something that might be going the homicide route. Based on the examination by the Division of Forensic Science, which is our medical examiner, and then based on our investigation, we don't believe it was an accident, and you know, it wasn't a snap ruling by the ME. So I think we're investigating it like a homicide, and we did it from the beginning. And again, that's, I keep saying that, you know, generally speaking, that you want to treat every death investigation like a homicide until you find out otherwise, because it's very easy to go from a homicide and then realize, okay, it's not a homicide, it's an accident, and kind of dial your investigation down. But if you treat something like an accident and then you find out a month later and it's a homicide, it's really difficult to ramp the investigation back up because you may have missed a lot. So from the beginning, my partner, I've treated it like a homicide. And that's, you know, that's what the medical examiner ruled.
Is suicide off the table?
Yes. Cause of death is blunt force trauma and drowning.
Was that blunt force trauma to the skull?
We haven't released the locations of the injuries to her body. That's an investigative strategy, I guess, is for lack of a better term, that we haven't even released that information to the family. I'll just say that the injuries were consistent with homicide.
The death of Susan Ledyard has turned into a homicide investigation. But what, if any, clues were left behind?
Was there anything in her car? Her purse, her cell phone, a jacket?
Her purse, her cell phone was inside her purse, as far as we know. And her school ID was on some kind of a lanyard or something, and it was hanging over her passenger side seat.
Also significant to the timeline, the weather. Was it raining?
So that's a tricky thing. It had rained the night before a bit here and there. It was dry when she left the house. They said bone dry. And then there was some light rain at other times. There was what I guess we would call torrential rain from 3:53 to 4:53 in the morning. That's what the detectives told us.
So 3:53 to 4, what? I was writing this down.
4:53.
To 4:53, hard rain. And
hard rain.
Her last known video, or her vehicle's last known video, is at 3:04. So about 50 minutes later, they're saying it was super raining, and then the car windshield wipers were found on. Which would be indicative of somebody sitting in the car while it's raining, enough to turn the windshield wipers on.
Right, or have gotten out and then came back to it. But at least, you know, maybe gotten out, walked around while it wasn't raining, and then gotten back in the car when it was. But hard to say. You know, we don't have, that I know of, we don't have clear enough video or picture.
And what about the distance from where Susan's body was found to where her vehicle was parked?
It's not likely that she drifted from where her car was 3 miles downriver to where her body was found. The river, for about, I'll say it's 3 miles between the car and where she was found. Probably for a good 2.5 of that, the water is mostly shallow and rocky, and the river twists. There's a lot of obstructions in the river, like dams and things like that. So it's not likely that she could have made it all the way down there without getting caught on something.
Looking for answers, Missy says that Ben told her what happened the night before Susan was found dead.
So what Ben said to me was that he got home from the movie with his friend, that his friend stayed at the house for a little bit. I think just on the porch, though, maybe 20 minutes. And then he left. Ben was there with Susan, and they shared a half a bottle of wine. And then they each took their respective sleep aids, him as Lunesta, her Ambien, and they went to bed. But then he said that in the morning he woke up and there was a broken wine glass on the porch.
In conducting their own investigation, Missy and her family try and retrace Susan's last moments.
So in the beginning, we just thought it was an accident, a combination of what we were told and then also just not being able to fathom anything else, and shock. The second, so not the day it happened, not the next day, but the following day. And Meg and my father and I went down to the creek where it happened. Actually, I should say where her car parked. And Meg and I walked down to the water and just could not conceive of how that whole thing happened. How you even impaired, you know, if you had taken Ambien, I did not see, you would have to be pretty out of it to end up in the river by accident. You know, it's very, it was tricky for us to get down there in the daytime, unimpaired. And so you, my feeling was you'd kind of have to make your way down there. You might stumble, you know, trip over a root. We had to hang on to some branches as we got down there. Now I'm talking about going straight from her car door to the water or thereabouts. It wasn't an easy process.
Experts were even brought in to analyze the scene.
A hydrogeologist take a look early on, and they were very skeptical that she could have gone from where the car was to where she was found. But it just seemed nearly impossible because of the obstructions, the obstacles.
Was Susan's death just a tragic accident? One where she was driving a vehicle under the influence of alcohol and Ambien? And what about the toxicology? We know there's wine, of course. Yes. Ambien.
Anything? There was no Ambien.
But I thought Ben said that they both took their respective sleeping pills and off to bed.
There was no Ambien. So that was a big surprise to us. Based on what we were told, we know that there was alcohol. We know that there were no illegal drugs. There was no Ambien. Detective Grassi told us that there was no Ambien.
That's a pretty significant piece of information.
It seems so to us.
Yeah.
I mean, it honestly, what it was for us mostly was just it was shocking because we were basing all of what we thought happened on the fact that she had taken Ambien. I can't tell you how many people called me, messaged me, how many people sent me links to articles that sourced Ambien sleepwalking, Ambien sleep driving, sleep eating, people I've known all my life telling me experiences after having taken Ambien. It almost seemed like there was no limit to the craziness that could happen on Ambien. So it allowed us to look at a scenario that would have seemed impossible to comprehend an accident happening there in that way. Kind of gave it license. And then to find out that there wasn't any just really shook us.
With the shocking new information that Ambien did not play a factor in Susan's death, the family had to look at alternative theories and scenarios. We asked Meg if Susan would have left her home to meet someone in the middle of the night.
She wasn't a secretive person. I mean, I'm not saying she didn't have things that she didn't share with people or with us. She wasn't a sneak around, kind of drama and, you know, this kind of shadowy meet up in the middle of the night. And, you know, if she was seeing someone, she would have told one of her friends. If it's a torrid love affair that's so heated that, you know, he kills her, then there's no possibility that we weren't aware of somebody and something going on and something happening. I had just been with her every day for almost 3 weeks. The thing that is the most vexing, though, of many vexing things, is that there's no trace of communication between her and someone else to meet up at a specific time or a specific place.
Love listening to this podcast? Well, we love that you are here to listen. Do you ever wonder what it's like to create a listening experience like this week to week?
Do your friends always tell you that you should have a podcast? Well, now is your chance. Our podcast network, Podcast One, is looking for the next podcast star. Think it could be you?
Enter the self-made podcast competition now to find out. All you have to do is visit launchpadone.com/self-made for a chance to win a contract with Podcast One, valued at over $100,000 in promotion and so much more.
Enter now until September 3rd and tell all of your friends to listen and download.
Go to launchpadone.com/self-made to find out more, see official rules, and sign up for your chance to win.
That's launchpadone.com/self-made. Now, Kelly, at this point, it's officially ruled a murder. So if there's zero traces of communication between Susan and another person on her phone, on her social media, you go to, was it a crime of opportunity? You know, was it a random attack? But statistically, murders by the hands of a stranger are much less likely to occur. Usually the killer is a known person. So where's the scale tipping at this point?
You really think this one is going to come down to physical forensics and possible eyewitnesses. Now, I really have to give the Delaware State Police credit on this case. You know, they didn't jump right to the suicide ruling. They have something that is pointing towards it being a homicide, something that they might be withholding. So whether that be a concrete piece of evidence, potential DNA, or something in the autopsy. Now, I have confidence that we'll find out what that is sooner rather than later. For Susan's family, I really do hope it's sooner.
We asked Detective Grossi, what about any evidence at the home Susan and Ben shared?
There's nothing we found that says anything had occurred at the house. It appears that she left willingly.
And no blood was found in her vehicle or no signs of a struggle or anything?
That's not something I would release.
So you guys are confident that it was Susan driving her vehicle away from her home?
I wouldn't say confident. But I guess I would say confident. We haven't found anything to say that it wasn't her driving away from the house. Now, you know, obviously the surveillance video we have is at night and we don't see who's in the car. We really just see the shape of the vehicle and the headlights. But, I'll just say there's nothing, we haven't found anything to say that it wasn't her driving the car.
With investigators feeling sure it was Susan in her Honda Civic that night, one more jaw-dropping piece of information in Susan's final hours is revealed by her sister, Missy.
She wore a wrist fitness tracker.
Well, what information was gathered from that?
That was what told us that her heart rate was, but this is one of those things that I have a hard time with still, that her heart rate stopped at 7 a.m. She was alive another 4 hours after she went to Walker's Mill.
Wow.
That was shocking. Because then you'd have to go back into her head, into the situation, and wonder what she was doing, what was happening.
Meg also has her concerns regarding the fitness tracker.
And so they're still analyzing the data, but, you know, based on what we know, before it's all analyzed, there was activity. You know, there's steps and a heart rate. So part of the analysis, of course, will be, well, could those steps be just movement in the current of the river? And if the steps were minimal, you know, if she only recorded 100 steps in those 4 hours, then I would say, yeah, it's possible that it was just, you know, kind of movement through the river. But there were enough steps that it seems to me that movement in the river can't account for that.
We have been told that there were no signs of a sexual assault, and Susan was still wearing the purple tank top Ben said she had on the night before. Because of a fitness tracker, the family and police feel they know the exact moment Susan's life was taken. So what happened between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m.?
If her fitness tracker indicates her heart stopped at 7 a.m., and the 911 call came in from the construction worker at 7:39 a.m., does that mean her killer was there and fled the scene within those 39 minutes?
Observation, I suppose, of her body was that she wasn't in the water for very long. You know, maybe 30 minutes at the most.
My friend Becky and I did a 6:30 a.m. stakeout down there in some spots where she could have been put into the river. Because if you think about it, her heart stopped at 7. There's a very good chance that whatever happened, happened during the daylight.
Yeah, what time did the sun come up?
You know, 5:54, something like that. There are a whole lot of people. There are parks along there. You know, there was the potential. There's a stretch in the beginning where it would be hard to be seen, maybe a little bit harder. But there's some condos that overlook the creek. There's the potential for somebody to have seen something. So we went down and wanted to see what cameras might be available, who was out and about, what businesses were open at that hour, some of the entry points that might have been more likely. I mean, we were doing anything and everything.
But Detective Grossi has a major lingering question.
That question, I think, is the key to everything, is why did she leave the house? I mean, I think that would provide a lot of answers if we could find out why she left the house at 3 a.m.
Meg has her own theory. Why do you think that she left the house at 3 to go to that specific location?
I have thought about that every day since it happened. It seemed to make sense that she went down there to meet someone. That did make sense to me. But at the same time, it seemed possible that she just wanted to leave the house, that she just got in the car and drove, and that didn't seem impossible for her to just say, I got to get out of here. I don't want to go to sleep. Can't sit here anymore and just go. I mean, that's not something she would do regularly, but it just seemed like it was possible. But of course, going there to meet up with someone for whatever reason.
Does Detective Grossi think Susan went to meet someone?
In any investigation, you don't want to get tunnel vision and get zeroed in on any one theory of the crime, whether it be a stranger or an acquaintance or anything like that. We gather the evidence, we see where it goes, and if it goes the route of a stranger or an acquaintance, we follow it. But I wouldn't say that we exclude any possibility, just speaking generally when it comes to investigations.
If Susan didn't text, call, or message anyone to meet her at Walker's Mill, and Ben said she took Ambien, but there was no Ambien in her system, where does that leave Ben Ledyard with Detective Grossi? Was or is Susan's husband, Ben, considered a person of interest or a suspect?
I'll just say that her husband has cooperated completely with this investigation from day one. He's been very helpful. And I'll say what I would say in any investigation, that no one has ever ruled out. We don't do an investigation to prove anyone innocent. I'll just say that he's been very helpful with this investigation. I don't think we would have gotten nearly as far as we have without his assistance. But I would never say that someone's been ruled out, because you can never say never about anything.
So in your heart of hearts, what do you think happened? What is your gut telling you happened to your sister, Susan?
You know, this is frustrating, and I can imagine that this might sound like a frustrating answer, but I honestly do not know. As I said in the beginning, I thought it was an accident, and I place a lot of importance on the shock of it all. I would never even go to homicide, just because my thought would be, who on earth would want to hurt her? And it just seemed like an odd place for something random to happen. It's just such a sleepy area down there. And if there wasn't a question of why she went down there, then maybe a random thing could happen. But both things together, we don't know why she went down there and it was random. Just, I don't know, that made it kind of difficult. My thoughts have changed over the course of the investigation. In the beginning, I thought it was an accident. Then they told us it was a homicide, and I trusted that it was a homicide. I had an incredibly difficult time imagining who on earth would want to kill her.
There is more than one victim here. Susan Ledyard, who was tragically and mysteriously murdered, and the family she left behind.
The two best times I ever had in my life were with her. And I'm lucky that I got a chance to tell her that. We went to Mexico for Christmas, two Christmases ago, and we were out to dinner, and we were sitting across from each other at the table, and I was telling her. So I'm glad that we had that time. I think probably the most I miss her laugh. Susan loved to laugh. And she was the sort that would laugh and launch forward and slap her leg. I just miss her so much.
If you have a message for the person or persons responsible for Susan's death, what is that message?
You know, this might be strange to hear, but I can't even wrap my head around a person yet without understanding more of what happened. So I feel kind of detached saying this. And I say that because I have a hard time getting angry about it. I'm just so heartbroken and so baffled that I feel like I can't get angry while I'm still so grief-stricken and still so baffled. I can get angry if anybody ever said anything disparaging about her, which, you know, how could they? But if anybody did, I'd hit the ceiling. So it's not that I can't feel anger. It's just, it's very hard for me to be angry at somebody who did this, because I feel it feels like a little out of body. But I would say, you took such an amazing person.
What do you miss most about your sister?
I miss texting with her. I miss her wit. I miss so many things about her. I miss her voice. She was just so fun to talk to.
But Missy will always have the sound of Susan's voice close by in the form of an old voicemail.
I love the J-I-F-G-L-E call me. We're on the road to the Eagles game. I'll try calling John too. Merry Christmas.
The family has now hired a private attorney to help investigate, and a reward will be offered by the family in the hopes that someone will come forward. In the meantime, what will stay active is her memory.
You go through different phases. Yeah. In the beginning, I couldn't look at her picture. And then finally, when I could, I got all sorts of frames together, and I probably had 10, you know, framed pictures of her just downstairs.
We've reached out to Ben Ledyard, who did not wish to be interviewed, but said he would like nothing more than to see Susan's tragic death brought to justice. We have learned that Ben is now engaged and plans to remarry. Again, detectives say he has fully cooperated with the investigation.
If you have any information about Susan Ledyard's murder, please contact the Delaware State Police. You can remain anonymous.